White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to tonight's program on January 23rd, 2014. I am Carolyn Yeager.
And I am Hadding Scott.
And we're reading Chapter 76 tonight about good old Lewis Marshall again. He's been discussed before, but he really personifies, I think, the tricky Jew because he has this reputation of being such a fine, upstanding, fair-minded person. But we're going to learn some more about him tonight, and it's really interesting. there's a lot that's interesting in this chapter, and it's over 4,000 words. So unless you want to say something in advance, Hattie, maybe we should get started.
All righty. International Jew, Chapter 76. America's Jewish Enigma, Lewis Marshall. Something of an enigma is Lewis Marshall, whose name heads the list of organized Jewry in America, and who is known as the arch-protester against most things non-Jewish. He is head of nearly every Jewish movement that amounts to anything, and he is chief opponent of practically every non-Jewish movement that promises to amount to something. Yet he is known mostly as a name, and not a very Jewish name at that. It would be interesting to know how the name of Marshall found its way to this Jewish gentleman. It is not a common name, even among Jews who change their names. Lewis Marshall is the only Marshall listed in the Jewish Encyclopedia, and the only Jewish Marshall in the index of the publications of the American Jewish Historical Society. In the list of the annual contributors to the American Jewish Committee are to be found such names as Marschutz, Meyer, Massal, Marmot, Mannheimer, Marx, Morse, Mackler, Marcus, Morris, Moskowitz, Marx, Margolis, and Marek. But only one Marshall, and that is Lewis. Of any other prominent Jew, it may be asked, which Strauss, which Untermeyer, which Kahn, which Schiff, but never which Marshall, for there is only one.
Well, here, let me just say here that in Wikipedia, which is another Jewish encyclopedia, actually, it said that His name was originally spelled with an S-C-H instead of just an S-H, you know, making it look more German.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I still would question whether that was their name or they took that name whenever they took that name. But his father came over, immigrated here in 1849 when he was only 19 years old at the time, and Lewis was born shortly after he and his parents arrived here. So he just, barely made it being a natural born U.S. citizen.
Well, I can think of some other Jewish Marshalls. There's the Jewish TV producer Gary Marshall and his homely sister, the wife Penny Marshall.
Hmm.
But maybe they took their name from Lewis Marshall.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of Jews named Marsh also.
Right. They, is Marshall with an S, with an S-C-H, a German name?
Well, it's the word for, like Marshall Hindenburg, right?
Uh-huh. Well, that sounds like a name Jews would take.
It's a little bit like being surnamed Caesar, I guess, like Sid Caesar.
Okay.
Oh, well.
Oh, right.
This in itself would indicate that Marshall is not a Jewish name. It is an American or an Anglo-Saxon name transplanted into a Jewish family. But how and why are questions to which the public as yet have no answer. Louis Marshall is head of the American Jewish Committee, and the American Jewish Committee is head of all Jewish activity in the United States. As head of the committee, he is also head of the executive committee of the New York Kehillah, an organization which is the active front of organized Jewry in the United States.
In New York.
And the center of Jewish propaganda for the United States. The nominal head of the Kehillah is Rabbi Judah L. Magnes, a brother-in-law of Louis Marshall. Not only are the American Jewish Committee and the Kehillah linked officially, see Chapter 33, Volume 2, reprint of this series, but they are linked domestically as well, by marriage.
Right.
Louis Marshall was president of all the Jewish committees of the world at the Versailles Peace Conference. And it is charged now, as it has been charged before, that the Jewish program is the only program that went through the Versailles Conference as it was drawn. And the so-called League of Nations is busily carrying out its terms today. A determined effort is being made by Jews to have the Washington Conference take up the same matter. Colonel House was Louis Marshall's chief aide at Paris, enforcing the Jewish program on an unwilling world. I don't know about that Washington conference.
You mean you don't know about it, or you don't agree with what they're saying here?
Did you look it up? Do you know what it is?
I didn't even pay attention. I was so busy thinking about the Versailles Treaty.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, the Versailles Conference that I didn't really even pay attention to. It's the Jews made by the Jews.
No doubt it was some opportunity for Jews to get things that they wanted, the Washington Conference.
Yeah, we should look. I'll look that up right now.
In general, Jews tend to favor highly centralized power because they have a better opportunity to focus their influence that way. It's farther away from the influence of ordinary people who are not Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the wealth that they can focus.
Okay, the Washington Conference was also called the Washington by name of International Conference on Naval Limitation. Did that have something to do with the Russian thing that he got all involved in?
I don't know.
It was 1921-1922 international conference called by the United States to limit the naval arms race and to work out security agreements in the Pacific area.
Oh.
It resulted in the drafting and signing of several major and minor treaty agreements. Well, the Four Power Pact between United States, Great Britain, Japan, and France. I can't read all this. Anglo-Japanese Alliance, five power naval limitation treaty, nine power pact, all kinds of things were signed at this. So I guess they were, of course, in there trying to get what they wanted. And I guess, according to International Jew, they did, huh?
Louis Marshall has appeared in all the great Jewish cases. The impeachment of Governor Sulzer was a piece of Jewish revenge, but Louis Marshall was Sulzer's attorney. Sulzer was removed from the office of governor. I looked up Sulzer.
Good.
It was William Plain Bill Sulzer was a populist who had been a congressman who promoted a lot of very pro-Jewish policies, like condemning the Tsar and getting Jewish, I don't know, just in general, things that were very favorable to Jews. He also introduced a bill that would ban the sales of munitions to Britain during the Second Boer War. But what happened was that after he was elected governor of New York in 1912, he bucked Tammany Hall in terms of making appointments to public offices that they wanted, Tammany, of course, being Jewish-controlled at that point. And they found various excuses to impeach him.
Uh-huh. So, there he was. He was impeached by them.
In the case of Leo Frank, a Jew, charged with the peculiarly vicious murder of a Georgia factory girl, was defended by Mr. Marshall. It was one of those cases where the whole world is whipped into excitement because a Jew is in trouble. It is almost an indication of the racial character of a culprit these days to note how much money is spent for him and how much fuss is raised concerning him. It seems to be a part of Jewish loyalty to prevent, if possible, the Gentile law being enforced against Jews. That's a great statement right there.
Yeah, really. And that fits right in with what Tan Stoffel is doing with his with his program these days, and looking deeply into the Frank case, or the Fagan case, whatever you want to call it. But and he points out all the time how, you know, what they insist that no Jew can be guilty of anything. And this goes on all around the world, where these Jewish organizations, international, have these top-notch Jewish lawyers like Lewis Marshall going down to Georgia for Leo Frank to exonerate Jews. They don't want any Jew ever to be convicted of any crime or to be punished for anything. It's amazing. If people could just think about it or recognize that, they would be struck by the injustice of it all.
The Dreyfus case and the Frank case are examples of the endless publicity the Jews secure in behalf of their own people. Frank was reprieved from the death sentence and sent to prison, after which he was killed. That horrible act can be traced directly to the state of public opinion, which was caused by raucous Jewish publicity, which stopped at nothing to attain its ends. To this day, the state of Georgia is, in the average mind, part of an association of ideas directly traceable to this Jewish propaganda. Jewish publicity did to Georgia what it did to Russia, grossly misrepresented it, and so ceaselessly as to create a false impression generally. It is not without reason that the Ku Klux Klan was revived in Georgia, and that Jews were excluded from membership.
Well, there you have him talking about cause, calling it reason, having a reason. But, you know, I often say that this idea that Jews have been disliked for no cause, you know, without cause, but there is cause. There's a lot of cause, and there's a lot of reasons why people get, you know, fed up with what the Jews are doing and want to get rid of them or want to do something with them. And here you have, they use the example of Georgia here and also Russia, and then you can put Germany into that same group, you know, as being grossly misrepresented by the Jews and a false impression created about what they were about. So that's a very good part.
Yeah, I could also point out that the original Ku Klux Klan at the time of Reconstruction in the South of the United States actually did admit Jews. Bernard Baruch's father was in the Ku Klux Klan, in the original Ku Klux Klan. But the revived Ku Klux Klan had a strong anti-immigrant position.
Well, is that why they became anti-Jewish, or were they just, you know, evolved and learned?
Well, immigration was basically synonymous with Jews.
Okay.
Foreign Jews, anyway. You know, Eastern Jews. Troublemaker Jews.
Yeah.
Was immigrants at that point. Lewis Marshall is chairman of the board and of the executive committee of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, whose principal theologian, Mordecai M. Kaplan, is the leading exponent of an educational plan by which Judaism can be made to supersede Christianity in the United States. Under cover of synagogal activities, which he knows that the well-known tolerance of the American people will never suspect, Rabbi Kaplan has thought out and systematized and launched a program to that end, certainly not without the approval of Mr. Marshall. Lewis Marshall is not the world leader of Jewry, but he is well advanced in Jewry's World Council, as is seen by the fact that International Jewry reports to him, and also by the fact that he headed the Jews at the Kosher Conference, as the Versailles assemblage was known, among those on the inside. Strange things happened in Paris. Mr. Marshall and Colonel House had affairs very well in hand between them. President Wilson sent a delegation to Syria to find out just what the contention of the Syrians was against the Jews. But that report has never seen the light of day. But it was the easiest thing imaginable to keep the president informed as to what the Jews of New York thought. That is, the few who had not taken up their residence in Paris.
Well, before you go to this example, you know, I just want to comment that this thing that they keep going on about how what the Jews managed to do at the Versailles talks and getting their way and so on, and this relationship between Marshall and Colonel House, who was there for Wilson, and how that all played out. And, you know, on on Monday, I had a program with Guillermo Rudolph and Bradley Smith. And dear Bradley, such a good man. He's such a good man, and I like him so very much. But, you know, he thinks that the Jews never did any of this stuff. They didn't do anything that he was talking about the World War One and how it was between all these white nations and how stupid they were to do the things they were doing, and, you know, I bet he has never read The International Jew, and probably wouldn't want to, has never even never considered it or wouldn't like it. I wonder if he would think it was anti-Semitic or whatever. But, you know, people are just completely, they don't take into consideration so much of this that's been going, that is known, and yet they would call it like, well, that's just that conspiracy stuff, you know, probably.
Well, you know, I think it goes too far in some things, you know, like giving too much credit to protocols of the Elders of Zion when it's probably not a genuine document. I mean, it clearly isn't. But
well, there you go again. It's going to come up later in this chapter. I'm going to have something to say about it. But I know we know that you think that. You're on record.
That's demonstrable. And, you know, and that would be a point where if Bradley Smith would disagree with the International Jew, he would be on solid ground. But I think the rest of it's very solid.
Well, what I'm saying is I doubt he's ever read it. Or would want to read it.
And well, I mean, isn't his whole perspective
is totally unaware?
I mean, he's really just a free thinker, isn't he?
Well, right. Yeah. The point is, he's a libertarian. He's always been libertarian. That's he's natural libertarian in his thinking. So that's always
see, if you're a libertarian,
his natural home.
If you're a libertarian, you can't really believe in the power of groups to control things.
Yeah, I know.
Because that messes up the whole libertarian theory.
I know. And that's the thing, you see, that's where he's, you know, where people who like that cannot, don't even want to look at this kind of thinking, don't even want to look at what's in the International Jews say. They probably all think it's something happened to Henry Ford and he went off the deep end or something. Well, anyway, so that's interesting. I thought this was an interesting part.
Okay. For example, this prominent dispatch in the New York Times of May 27th, 1919. Wilson gets full report of Jewish protest here. Copyright 1919 by the New York Times Company. By wireless to the New York Times. Harris, May 26th. Louis Marshall, who has succeeded Judge Mack as head of the Jewish Committee in Paris, was received by President Wilson this afternoon and gave him a long cabled account of the Jewish mass meeting recently held in Madison Square Garden, including the full text of the resolutions adopted at the meeting and editorial comment in The Times and other papers. When Russia fell, Louis Marshall hailed it with delight. The New York Times begins its story on March 19th, 1917.
2 years earlier than this other one.
Hailing the Russian upheaval as the greatest world event since the French Revolution, Louis Marshall, in an interview for the New York Times last night, said a number of things, among which was the statement that the events in Russia were no surprise. Of course, they were not. The events being of Jewish origin, and Mr. Marshall being the recipient of the most intimate international news.
Well, see, now here again, Bradley brought out that, I'm not picking on Bradley, people, I hope it doesn't sound like that. Bradley brought out that, that in World War I, one of the worst things was the Russian Tsar. He didn't have a clue. He didn't know what he was doing. He did such stupid things. You know, blaming the Tsar rather than blaming all these events behind the scene and what was being done and so on. He may not have understood what was going on, but who did at that time? You know, except for the protocols, they understood.
Well, I think Matthew Raphael Johnson might give a different perspective on that.
Well, he might, but I'm not, I don't.
Russia was very progressive under the Tsars. I don't know about Nicholas II specifically, but
they weren't doing that badly. What the Jews ended up doing, what the Bolsheviks ended up doing after, as we already read, misrepresenting the Russian government and so on terribly, then they did so much worse and made things so much worse for everybody. I mean, it's just not even comparable. So, but these are things that people just don't pay, are just looking at the surface events amongst the Europeans, you know, and not looking at what the Jews were doing. And then they'll say, oh, what could they do? There were so few of them. They couldn't, what could they accomplish if the European people weren't, you know, doing all the things they were doing or letting them get away with it and so on.
Okay, wasn't it what Bradley Smith said is all the Tsar had to do was feed the people? Isn't that what he said?
Oh, I don't remember hearing that.
I've heard that criticism, and that's actually a pretty good criticism. There were a lot of people, as I understand, that just were starving at the time. What they needed was the government to just cut the Gordian knot and take the food from where it was and put it to where it needed to be, which is what the Bolsheviks promised to do, and they got a lot of support because of that. A military dictator could have done the same thing, you know. These are things that have to be done. And that general idea was incorporated into fascism and then National Socialism, the idea that the nation is an entity where individual rights do not take priority over the survival of the nation. If there's a concentration of resources in one part of the population and another part of the population is in desperate straits because of the lack of it, you do the redistribution that you have to do.
Yeah, and so the Tsar was just letting this stuff go on and wasn't taking any action because maybe of the power of the privileged classes and so on.
Well, then there was the liberal government that was after the czars, and I don't think they solved the problem either. It's liberal ideas are the problem.
Okay.
Liberal in the 19th century sense, which we call conservatism. That's the problem. All right. Even the new Russian revolutionary government made reports to Louis Marshall, as is shown by the dispatch printed in the New York Times of April 3, 1917, in which Baron Günzburg reports what had been done to assure to the Jews the full advantage of the Russian upheaval. The full advantage of the Russian upheaval. This glorification of the Jewish overthrow of Russia, it must be remembered, occurred before the world knew what Bolshevism was, and before it realized that the revolution meant the withdrawal of the whole Eastern Front from the war. Russia was simply taken out of the war, and the Central Powers left free to devote their whole attention to the Western Front. One of the resulting necessities was the immediate entrance of America into the conflict and the prolongation of the hostilities for nearly two more years. Well, that's only necessary if you start from the premise that Britain and France must win. They could have made peace with Germany in 1917, but they wouldn't, because they had this promise that the Jews would bring the United States into the war.
So there you go. So look at how important the Jews were to that. Look at how they were essential to what all happened. Britain was hand in hand with Jews, as it always has been for so darn long, listening to them and letting them help, you know, accepting their help and their assistance with promises. That's where the Balfour Declaration came from and all that. So, you know, Jews played a huge role in what was going on in this ridiculous and horrible World War I.
As the truth became known, Louis Marshall first defended, then explained, then denied, his latest position being that the Jews are against Bolshevism. He was brought to this position by the necessity of meeting the testimony of eyewitnesses as given to congressional investigation committees. This testimony came from responsible men whom even Mr. Marshall could not dispose of with a wave of his hand. And as time has gone on, the testimony has increased to mountainous proportions. That Bolshevism is Jewish in its origin, its method, its personnel, and its purpose. Herman Bernstein, a member of Mr. Marshall's American Jewish Committee, has lately been preparing American public opinion for a great anti-Semitic movement in Russia. Certainly it will be an anti-Semitic movement because it will be anti-Bolshevist, and the Russian people, having lived with the hybrid for 5 years, are not mistaken as to its identity.
Mm-hmm.
During the war, Mr. Marshall was the arch protester. While Mr. Baruch was running the war from the business end, I probably had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war. Doubtless, that is true, said Mr. Baruch.
He was a Southern man.
Oh.
Remember, when we were doing him a lot, you had a good accent for him, I remember going, but you've forgotten it.
Mr. Marshall was running, I just wanted to indicate that he was Jewish, but
I know.
Mr. Marshall was running another side. We find him protesting because an army officer gave him instructions as to his duties as a registration official. It was Mr. Marshall who complained to the Secretary of War that a certain camp contractor, after trying out carpenters, had advertised for Christian carpenters only. It was to the discrimination in print that Mr. Marshall chiefly objected, it may be surmised, since it is the policy of his committee to make it impossible, or at least unhealthy, to use print to call attention to the Jew. It was Mr. Marshall who compelled a change in the instructions sent out by the Provost Marshal General of the United States Army to the effect that the foreign-born, especially Jews, are more apt to malinger than the native-born. It is said that a Jewish medical officer afterward confirmed this part of the instruction, saying what experience proved it. Saying that experience proved it. Nevertheless, President Wilson ordered that the paragraph be cut out.
But you see, the things that used to be said, because they were recognized, and people then were not afraid to say it, except that the Jews were busy making it, you know, making it not okay to say it, using all their influence. But, you know, they would say, come right out and say it, especially Jews, are more apt to malinger, because that was the experience that people had.
It was so a common sense observation made by ordinary people with their eyes open.
That's right.
And you can't say that now.
Yeah, just like I recall when you could say that that Negroes didn't work very well, and if, you know, they were lazy and things like that. You could say that.
A lot of crimes.
Yeah, but at that time it was more like they just you couldn't expect a whole lot out of them, you know. But that was the way it was. But now you can't say that, even though it's true.
Yeah.
So.
It was Mr. Marshall who compelled the revision of the Plattsburgh Officer's Training Manual. That valuable book rightly said that the ideal officer is a Christian gentleman. Mr. Marshall wrote, wired, demanded, and the edition was changed. It now reads that the ideal officer is a courteous gentleman. A big drop in idealism. There was nothing too unimportant to draw forth Mr. Marshall's protest. To take care of protests alone, he must have a large organization. And yet, with all this high-tension pro-Jewish activity, Mr. Marshall is not a self-advertising man, as is his law partner Samuel Untermyer, who has been referred to as the arch-inquisitor against the Gentiles. Marshall is a name, a power, not so much a public figure. As an informed Jew said about the two men, no, Marshall doesn't advertise himself like Sam, and he has never tried to feature himself in the newspapers for personal reasons. Outside his professional life, he devotes himself exclusively to religious affairs. That is the way the American Jew likes to describe the activities referred to above. Religious affairs. We shall soon see that they are political affairs. Mr. Marshall is short, stocky, and aggressive. Like his brother-in-law, Rabbi Magnes, he works on the principle that the Jew can do no wrong. For many years, Mr. Marshall has lived in a four-story brownstone house of the old-fashioned type with a grilled door in East 72nd Street. This is an old-time swell neighborhood, once almost wholly occupied by wealthy Jews. It was as close as they could crowd to the choice Fifth Avenue corners, which had been preempted by the Vanderbilts, the Astors, and other rich families. That Mr. Marshall regards the whole Jewish program in which he is engaged, not in its political aspect alone, not in its religious aspect alone, but in its worldwide political aspect, may be judged from his attitude on Zionism. Mr. Marshall wrote in 1918 as follows, I have never been identified and am not now in any way connected with the Zionist organization. I have never favored the creation of a sovereign Jewish state. But Mr. Marshall says, let the Zionists go on. Don't interfere with them. Why? He writes, Zionism is but an incident of a far-reaching plan. It is merely a convenient peg on which to hang a powerful weapon. All the protests that non-Zionists may make, would be futile to affect that policy. He says that opposition to Zionism at that time would be dangerous. I could give concrete examples of a most impressive nature in support of what I have said. I am not an alarmist, and even my enemies will give me credit for not being a coward. But my love for our people is such that even if I were disposed to combat Zionism, I would shrink from the responsibilities that might be entailed were I to do so.
And see, he's allowed to have all this love for his people.
Yeah.
My love for our people. When he says our people, he means only the Jewish people. I mean, that's even
he's
clear.
Not talking about America?
No. You know?
Oh.
And he's not an American, so he's here working for some kind of Jewish rights, you know, and therefore he does all this for them, for that reason. And he says so. You know, they have to telegraph that to the Jews and at the same time try to not make the Gentiles notice it too much.
Yeah.
So they use
a certain amount of code language.
Yeah, right.
And in concluding this strange pronouncement, he says, "Give me the credit of believing that I am speaking advisedly." Which I guess means with a certain amount of code language. Of course, a little bit of nudge, nudge, wink, wink there. Of course, there is more to Zionism than appears on the surface. But this is as close as anyone can come to finding a Jewish admission on the subject. If in this country there is apprehension over the Jewish problem, the activities of Lewis Marshall have been the most powerful agents to evoke it. His propagandas have occasioned great resentment in many sections of the United States. His opposition to salutary immigration laws, his dictation to book and periodical publishers, as in the recent case of G.P. Putnam's Sons, who modified their publishing program on his order, his campaign against the use of Christological expressions by federal, state, and municipal officers, all have resulted in alarming the native population and harming the very cause he so indiscreetly advocates. That this defender of Jewish rights and restless advocate of the Jewish religious propaganda should make himself the leader in attacking the religion of the dominant race in this country, in ridiculing Sunday laws and heading an anti-Christianity campaign, seems, to say the least, inconsistent. Mr. Marshall, who is regarded by the Jews as their greatest constitutional lawyer since the decline of Edward Lauterbach, and that is a tale, originated in a series of legal arguments, the contention that this is not a Christian country, nor a Christian government. This argument he has expounded in many writings. He has built up a large host of followers among contentious Jews who have elaborated on this theme in a variety of ways. It is one of the main arguments of those who are endeavoring to build up a united Israel in the United States. Mr. Marshall maintains that the opening of deliberative assemblies and conventions with prayer is a hollow mockery. He ridicules the absurd phrase, "in the name of God, amen," as used in the beginning of wills. He opposes Sunday observance legislation as being the cloak of hypocrisy. He advocates crushing out every agitation which tends to introduce into the body politic the virus of religious controversy. But Mr. Marshall himself has spent the last 20 years of his life in the virus of religious controversy. A few of his more impertinent interferences have been noted above. These are, in the Jewish phrase, rebellious activities.
Where'd you get rebellious?
Oh, religious, excuse me. Whoop. These are, in the Jewish phrase, religious activities. With a decidedly political tinge. I don't know, it's like my brain was saying, it's not religious, it's rebellious. Okay, something like that. The following extracts are quoted from the Contentions of Mr. Marshall, published in the Menorah Journal, the official organ of the Jewish Chautauqua, that the United States is not a Christian country. Is ours a Christian government? By Louis Marshall.
Now, this is an article in a journal. Can you read it without, like he's talking, because it's just a written thing?
Okay.
Thank you.
Article by Louis Marshall. When, in 1892, Mr. Justice Brewer, in rendering the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States in the case of the Church of the Holy Trinity against the United States, 144 U.S. 457, which involved an interpretation of the alien labor law, indulged in the obiter remark that this is a Christian nation. Obiter means passing, a passing remark.
Oh, I didn't know. I wondered about that strange word.
Supreme Court Justice Brewer made a passing remark that this was a Christian nation.
Okay.
A subject was presented for the consideration of thoughtful minds, which is of no ordinary importance. The dictum of Mr. Justice Story in Vidal against Girard's executors, 2 Howe U.S. 198, I don't know what Howe is.
I don't either.
To the effect that Christianity was a part of the common law of Pennsylvania, is also relied upon, but is not an authoritative judicial determination of that proposition. The remark was not necessary to the decision. The remarks of Mr. Justice Brewer, to which reference has already been made, were also unnecessary to the decision rendered by the court. The fact that oaths are administered to witnesses, that the hollow mockery is pursued of opening deliberative assemblies and conventions with prayer, that wills begin with the absurd phrase, "In the name of God, Amen," that gigantic missionary associations are in operation to establish Christian missions in every quarter of the globe, were also instanced. But none of these illustrations affords any valid proof in support of the assertion that this is a Christian nation. Our legislation relative to the observance of Sunday is such a mass of absurdities and inconsistencies that almost anything can be predicated thereon, except the idea that our legislators are impressed with the notion that there is anything sacred in the day. According to the views of any section of the Christian Church, the acts which I have enumerated as permitted would be regarded as sinful. Their legality in the eye of the law is a demonstration that the prohibitory enactments relating to Sunday are simply police regulations. And it should be the effort of every good American citizen to liberalize our Sunday legislation still more, so that it shall cease to be the cloak of hypocrisy. As a final resort, we are told by our opponents that this is a Christian government because the majority of our citizens are adherents of the Christian faith. That this is a government of majorities because government means force, and majorities represent the preponderance of strength. This is a most dangerous doctrine.
Just think about Israel and their government when you read this by Louis Marshall. Very, very, very dangerous doctrines they have there, right?
Well, I think they have more of a racial than a religious state. Most of the Jews, they're probably atheists.
Well, yeah, he's talking about religion, but it's the same thing. He's saying that the government of majorities is a government of force, and government of majorities is dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's trying to, you know, give more rights to the minority.
Well, I mean, obviously, that's the kind of, you know, principle that may or may not bother you, depending on where you stand, you know, what your interests are.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we don't have time to discuss it, so I'll wait and see. We want to make sure we get finished with this. And
we'll finish. Time. If the Christianity of the United States is to be, not reading from the Jew anymore.
Right.
If the Christianity of the United States is to be questioned, the last person to initiate the inquiry should be a member of that race which had no hand in creating the Constitution or in the upbuilding of the country.
Well, that's good. I think that's very good.
Christian prayers in public are a hollow mockery, and Sunday laws are unreasonable, the last person in the world to oppose them should be a Jew. Mr. Marshall, well, he's taking the position that he's defending Christianity, apparently.
He's saying that if people want to criticize the religion of the United States as being Christianity, then it shouldn't be Jews doing it.
Right.
They don't have any right.
Okay, Mr. Marshall has the advantage of being an American by birth. He was born in Syracuse, New York, in 1856, the son of Jacob and Zilly Marshall. After practicing law in Syracuse, he established himself in New York, became a Wall Street corporation lawyer, and his native country has afforded him generous means to win a large fortune. The question arises whether it is patriotic for Mr. Marshall to implant into the minds of his foreign-born co-religionists the idea that this is not a Christian country, that Sunday laws should be opposed, and that the manners and customs of the native-born should be scorned and ridiculed. The effect has been that thousands of immigrant Jews from Eastern Europe are persistently violating Sunday laws in the large industrial centers of the country, that they are hailed into court, lectured by judges, and fined. American Jews who are carrying into practice the teachings of Mr. Marshall and his followers are reaping the whirlwind of a natural resentment. Mr. Marshall was the leader of the movement which led to the abrogation of the treaty between the United States and Russia. Whenever government boards or committees are appointed to investigate the actions, conduct, or conditions of foreign-born Jews, great influences are immediately exerted to have Mr. Marshall made a member of such bodies to protect the Jewish interests. As head of millions of organized Jews in the United States, Mr. Marshall has invariably wielded this influence by means of a campaign of protests to silence criticisms of Jewish wrongdoing. He thus protested when testimony was made before the Senate subcommittee in Washington in 1919 that the Jewish East Side of New York was the hotbed of Bolshevism. Again, he protested to Norman Hapgood against the editorial in Harper's Weekly criticizing the activities of Jewish lobbyists in Washington. Mr. Marshall describes himself in Who's Who as a leader in the fight for the abrogation of the treaty with Russia. That was a distinct interference in America's political affairs and was not a religious activity connected with the preservation of Jewish rights in the United States. The limiting expression in the United States is, of course, our own assumption. It is doubtful if Mr. Marshall limits anything to the United States. He is a Jew, and therefore an internationalist. He is ambassador of the international Jewry, international nation of Jewry. He is an ambassador of the international nation of Jewry to the Gentile world.
That's a good line too, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's about what he is. He's not a part of the Gentile world. He comes into the Gentile world in order to represent Jewry. In his, you know, because he's so good at it.
He's a lawyer.
Yeah, right. Skill.
The pro-Jewish fights in which Mr. Marshall has been engaged in this country make a considerable list. He fought the proposal of the Census Bureau to enumerate Jews as a race. As a result, there are no official figures except those prepared by the American Jewish Committee as to the Jewish population of the United States. The census has them listed under a score of different nationalities, which is not only a non-descriptive method, but a deceptive one as well. At a pinch, the Jewish authorities will admit of 3,500,000 Jews in the United States. The increase in the amount of Passover bread in the United States, the increase in the amount of Passover bread required would indicate that there are 6 million in the United States now.
6 million! Wow!
But the government of the United States is entirely at sea, officially, as to the Jewish population of this country, except as the Jewish government in this country, as an act of courtesy, passes over certain figures to the government. The Jews have a foreign office through which they deal with the government of the United States. Mr. Marshall also fought the proposed naturalization laws that would deprive Asiatics of the privilege of becoming naturalized citizens. This was something of a confession. Whenever there were extradition cases to be fought, preventing Jewish offenders from being extradited, Mr. Marshall was frequently one who assisted. This also was part of his religious activities, perhaps. He fought the right of the United States government to restrict immigration. He has appeared oftener in Washington than any other Jew on this question. In connection with this, it may be suggested to Mr. Marshall that if he is really interested in upholding the law of the land and restraining his own people from lawless acts, he could busy himself with profitable results if he would look into the smuggling of Jews across the Mexican and Canadian borders. And when that service is finished, he might look into the national Jewish system of bootlegging, which, as a Jew of religious activities, he should be concerned to break up. Louis Marshall is a leader of that movement which will force the Jew by law into places where he is not wanted.
Okay, now they don't just say he's a leader, they say he is leader. He's leader of this movement.
Yeah.
Right.
The leader. The law compelling hotel keepers to permit Jews to make their hotels a place of resort if they want to has been steadily pushed. Such a law is practically a Bolshevik order to destroy property, for it is commonly known what Jewish patronage does for public places. It's probably changed a little bit since 100 years ago. You know, the Jews are a bit more assimilated, most of them.
Yeah. At that time, people just wanted to stay away from Jews, wanted Jews to stay away from them.
Where a few respectable Jews are permitted, others flock. And when one day they discover that the place they patronize is becoming known as a Jew hotel or a Jew club, then all the Jews abandon it. But they cannot take the stigma with them. The place is known as a Jew place, but lacks both Jew and Gentile patronage as a result. When Louis Marshall succeeded in compelling That's like what Groucho Marx said. I wouldn't want to join.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the thing is, it who it injures is the owner of the establishment. That's who suffers from it in the end. His business is ruined.
But, anyway, but it's exactly what Groucho Marx said. I wouldn't want to join a club that would have me as a member. Mm-hmm. Apparently it's literally true. When there are too many Jews in a particular establishment, Jews don't want to go there anymore. When Louis Marshall succeeded in compelling by Jewish pressure and Jewish threats the Congress of the United States to break the treaty with Russia, he was laying a train of causes which resulted in a prolongation of the war and the utter subjugation of Russia. Russia serves the world today as a living illustration of the ruthlessness, the stupidity, and the reality of Jewish power.
Endless now, we've only got 4 minutes, less than 4 minutes.
Yeah, endless power, fanatically mobilized for a vengeful end, but most stupidly administered. Does Mr. Marshall ever reflect on the grotesque stupidity of Jewish leadership? It is regretted that space does not permit the publication here of the correspondence between Mr. Marshall and Major G.H. Putnam, the publisher, as set forth in the annual report of the American Jewish Committee. It illustrates quite vividly the methods by which Mr. Marshall secures the suppression of books and other publications he does not like. Mr. Marshall, assisted by factors which are not mentioned in his letter, procured the suppression of the protocols after the House of Putnam had them ready to publish, and procured later the withdrawal of a book on the Jewish question, which had attracted wide attention both here and in England. Mr. Marshall apparently has no confidence in absurdities appearing absurd to the reader, nor of lies appearing false, but he would constitute himself a censor and a guide of public reading as well as of international legislation. If one might hazard a guess, Mr. Marshall's kind of leadership is on the wane.
Well, there we go. 26 November 1921. Very good, Hattie. You know, I do want to mention here that they're making the point that that Louis Marshall and others worked very hard to stop the publication of the protocols by any major publisher. And yet you had said way back earlier in our series here that that the Jews would just love it when we bring up the protocols. And
yeah, they
Abe
do.
Foxman just loves it because it makes those of us look so stupid. Well, they didn't. They weren't.
They didn't then, but it's different now because the thing has been thoroughly debunked.
Well, I don't think so. I think
see,
they
when
would
you make
still
reference
be against
to the
it.
Protocols
they still,
now, you're talking about something that's been.
They don't. They still don't want people to talk about it. There's
yeah,
not
they do.
Like. You give me one example.
Yeah, I give you an example. Conrad Haydn's biography of Hitler, the first chapter
well,
is all about
Haydn,
the protocol.
Conrad Haydn, he's a liar. Well, you know.
The first chapter of Conrad Haydn's biography of Hitler pretends that Hitler got all of his ideas from the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. And the reason why he wants to say that is because the protocols have been discredited. And that's to discredit Hitler, even though Hitler had very little reference to the protocols, just one page.
Okay. All righty. Well, we've got to go. It's time to close up this program. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen. We had more than the usual listeners. We'll see you next week for the next panel.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.